So, Ian, you were in Arnhem Land in the 60s. What did you find in relation to Indigenous people, land management and biodiversity?
Well, I had a fascination for Indigenous people and the way they related to their country. And I think I was very, very lucky because in the 60s, the adults in the communities in eastern Arnhem Land, and particularly Elko Island where I was and Lake of Vella, were traditionally born people, people who were born on their land in the bush, away from hospitals and away from technology, and they spent around about the first half of their lives doing traditional things, hunting, land management things. Then as the community at Elko Island got going, people began drifting in for all sorts of advantages and to see what was going on and join in with things. And as a result, their children tended to be born from there on in a more Western way. So that had a big influence on the next generation. I was lucky enough to be working with the parents and their offspring. And already in the 60s, I could see there was a loss of knowledge because the kids weren't on their country all the time. They were still very, very connected to the land and they still had access to their parents for information. But you could see there was a disconnect coming and it was going to get bigger and bigger. So for me, that was a bit scary. But at the same time, I had access to a lot of traditional information, which is now not on the menu at all, no longer available. That generation is pretty much gone. And now we've moved forward at least another two generations, so that my students are now mostly grandparents. And the children that are in the community today are almost in the same situation that our Western kids are in the suburbs here. What they know is hearsay, not experience. And they've been basically forced as a society to join into mainstream education. Mainstream education has cost them a traditional education, and they've had no choice in that. And sadly, Australia sort of looks at its Aboriginal population and says, oh, well, they've got to learn to read. They've got to learn to be competitive. People who say that really have no idea what those people are going to sacrifice in order to join in to our way of thinking and our way of operating. It's costing them dearly.
Mm. For a while there, it looked a bit like projects like Nightingale were going to bridge that gap, and potentially still could, but the system doesn't seem to have the capability to pick up on those sorts of things and run with it. At the moment, we've got a learning on country movement starting to come through. Do you think that might help bridge that gap?
I'm finding that the current generations are getting hungrier again for traditional knowledge. They're starting to realise that their grandparents and all generations beyond that were fully equipped to operate in this northern landscape, on their country, and they aren't. So there is a strong move now by some of the younger generations to get that back while there's still access to some of it, at least some of it. So yes, there's an enthusiasm there. The Australian education system does not seem to be paying attention to the fact that we have two different cultures against each other, and that Aboriginal culture is the loser when it comes to education because apart from some tokenism in the curricula, Aboriginal people don't get access to their former learning patterns or even to their parents and grandparents. They've got to be in school listening to somebody from somewhere else tell them something that's probably not going to be relevant to their future lives.
Yeah. So if we were going to get movement on that front with biodiversity, it would be important to get that education system back into...
Exactly right. I mean, the system can't see it. Our education system, to me, after all these years working in with these traditional people, our education system is almost totally blind and not that interested in seeing.
Yeah.
They're on a course. They're trying to make everybody the same. They're trying to fit everybody into categories, make their job easier, bring their costs down. And as a result, these people are being robbed of one of the oldest cultures on earth and the knowledge that went with it.
Yeah. So you were also involved in setting up Kakadu National Park, and you were lucky enough to work extensively with the traditional people in Kakadu when it was formed. Can you just talk a little about your experiences then and what you learned from them and the perspectives that gave you on the land management issues and also the biodiversity outcomes that have come out of that?
Well, again, that flowed on from what I had been doing. I got involved with mainly with secondary students looking back at their culture and trying to capture the good information from their culture that would be good for other cultures, all other cultures living on the same landscape, and perhaps putting that information into other Australian schools so that all our students could have access to it, to the traditional information that was available at the time. Kakadu National Park started basically as a secondary gesture to uranium mining in order for the federal government to get access to the uranium deposits. Kakadu National Park was a concession and was formed. Now, a whole bunch of us were involved from the start with that. We had stars in our eyes. I guess we saw this wonderful concept of joint management being actually joint management. As it's turned out, it's just another form of the Australian Public Service with a bit of tokenism thrown in. They don't want to let go of the system that they have. Aboriginal people have been very disappointed, basically, with the outcomes and don't have much power to change that. However, in the early days of Kakadu National Park, we had traditional owners, again, who were born in the bush and were born with one set of values. During their lifetimes, they had to adopt a second set of values. They were somewhere in the middle. Their kids were quite different to them. Their kids were getting a Western education and being dazzled by everything that goes with that. And so we saw a great shift from the end of a long dynasty into the modern mode that their children and grandchildren are now in. We did, for many years, have a wonderful window into the original Kakadu and how it was run. I think the federal government got carried away with technology and the fact that it was running this wonderful big new dynamic park and had more confidence in itself than it had in the traditional owners in managing the place. That was probably the biggest problem. And as a result, suddenly from a wonderful healthy ecosystem, we saw cracks appearing. We saw threatened species appearing from virtually no animals in trouble to almost all small vertebrate animals in Kakadu today are in trouble in the time that the federal government has been jointly managing that place.
Yeah.
It's wound backwards seriously.
I can remember when we did the NT Animals project with the Threatened Species Network, which just started, and they came to talk to us one day, and it was a real struggle to find animals to actually list on their threatened species list. And I think we got as far as gouldian and finches and golden bandicoots in those days, and now you can write a list as long as your arm.
Yeah. Well, there are many wonderful species in that area, that Alligator Rivers region, wonderful place for biodiversity. They were restricted to small areas. The distributions were small, but within their areas, they were quite common. Mm. Things like Ulmpelly pythons, black wallaroo, white-throated grass wren. Well, today, all of those things are in some degree of trouble, and the federal government can't tell you why. We know that the fire management hasn't been very good. They didn't pay attention to, I don't think, enough attention to the old traditional people that we used to have. They're all gone now, in terms of how they were managing that land for so long and maintaining those species at a healthy level. Mm. That sort of didn't come into the picture until very recently, and those people are gone. The teachers, so we've got a generation gap now. And it's very clear that the modern technology that's available through the federal government, helicopters for burning and boats and things like that, none of that has really done the country any good. Mm. And I think we've overlooked all the key things and been carried away with modern technology and science to the detriment of the landscape. So, yeah, we're in a serious situation now there.
Yeah. So with that cultural knowledge about land management and the obvious biodiversity outcomes that come from that, can you just reflect a little on what you learnt from those early people in Arnhem Land and those early people in Kakadu about the way, I guess, the responsibility for managing land fits in with your cultural responsibilities and the whole aspect of biodiversity that comes off that?
One of the things that struck me when I was young was the fact that every animal species on the landscape not only was a unique thing that they knew all about in fine detail, but it had a human aspect to it, which I took me a few years to tune in on what was going on there. But whether it was a golden bandicoot or a green turtle or a saltwater crocodile, that species was connected to a human group, a clan group in Arnhem Land, and they had responsibility for the well-being of that animal. They sang the songs and they danced the dances and they passed on the information, and they, out of all the clans, and there were something like 30-odd clans in my area, mm-hmm. of all the other clans, they were responsible for that species and that species and that species and that species of tree, of animal, of fish, and all clans have lots of them.
Yeah.
And everybody knows what animal is attached to what clan group and vice versa. So suddenly you've got a taxonomic system which is attached to a social system, and they're woven together. And as a result, every animal species on the landscape is being monitored by humans. To my way of thinking, that's where we Westerners went wrong. We just see the science, you know, it's all out there, and you know, you put a boundary around it and call it a national park and have really, really good, impressive legislation so that nobody interferes with it. It's fine. It's not fine. It's very unfine. In fact, in our national parks now, we've put fences around areas to let animals go extinct in, and nobody can touch them, nobody can do anything about it except a couple of public servants who don't want to let go of the power they have. So we've made a real problem for ourselves.
So that active management role, responsibility with Indigenous people, that way of looking at the country that it's your responsibility to manage it, and that quite small-scale management that comes as a result of that, can you reflect a little on how you think that might be impacting on biodiversity change and the way it's changed since that cultural system broke up?
Well, I think looking back now, that is one of the obvious symptoms of disconnecting people with landscape. If you think of any national park now, it's got a bunch of rangers in it. They're nice people. They're concerned with nature, but they're not in any way attached to the animals. They're just there to kind of drive around and make sure everything's in order. They don't have any sort of spiritual attachment to those animals necessarily. Whereas Aboriginal people feel very differently about the landscape. And I can always remember some little primary school girls. One day we're out on a class excursion and there's three little girls beside me, and one little girl looked up and she said, "There goes Grandma." And she pointed at a little flock of red-tailed black cockatoos flying over. And I was only a new teacher and nobody laughed. And I see Grandma flying over, I think that's a red-tailed black cockatoo. Anyway, I followed that up gently without causing a fuss. And of course, Grandma belongs to a Dua Moiety clan on Howard Island, the island next door to us. And one of the big, not totems, but one of the big animals affiliated with that clan was the red-tailed black cockatoo. It was their story. And that was where her grandma came from.
Yeah.
So as far as she was concerned, that red-tailed black cockatoo flying over represented Grandma.
Yeah.
And that's how she felt about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between us Westerners mm-hmm. and Aboriginal people in terms of how we look at stuff and therefore how we manage it. We're scientific, you know. We see humans as totally apart from ecology, whereas Aboriginal people see themselves as an integral part of it. And I think we've got to start thinking that way too.
So I remember you telling me some stories about the level of knowledge and the intimate knowledge that Indigenous people hold about animals and their behaviours and their desires, and the problems you had in the early days of getting scientists and stuff to actually pay attention to that. And you once told me a great anecdote about Nick Gambold with the Golden Bandicoot story on, I think, Howard Island or one of those islands up there. Can you just reflect a little on the way that concept of getting information from Indigenous people to help inform science should be working in your view, and some of the anecdotes you know about from your experience?
Right, well, this is repeated again and again. And an ecologist friend of ours who was researching the golden bandicoot, which is one of the first vertebrate species to get into serious trouble up here in North Australia, went from very common to gone almost on the mainland of the whole northern region here. But it was a species that, because it had recently disappeared, all its knowledge was still held amongst the local people. When the scientists went up to this particular island, it still had a population of them on it, and they tried to trap and estimate the number of animals in the population. They had very little success in trapping. So in our Western way of thinking, that would automatically mean that there are not very many bandicoots left on that island, maybe a couple. At the 11th hour, one of the or two of the old Aboriginal ladies, traditional owners who accompanied the scientific group up there, said, look, if you want to catch bandicoots, you've got to use guku. Guku is sugar bag, wild honey. That's how you'll catch bandicoots. And so they tried. The ladies dug up some sugar bag bees nests and got the honey out, put it in the mammal traps, and clunk, 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 they were catching bandicoots everywhere. And that's the sort of thing. And even my students in primary school knew all that stuff about all the animals, you know, what they ate, when they bred, when they had lots of body fat, when was the best time of the year to hunt them, and when not to hunt them because they were in poor condition or they'd just been breeding. All this information was general knowledge. All that information pretty much has been stomped out of them by our education system. Mm-hmm. And today, the same age kids in the same community don't know any of that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And now we're getting into trouble at high-level land management for that very reason. And our education system is still saying they have to learn English. Forget this bilingual stuff, which is where all their scientific knowledge is tied up in their own languages. Forget that. They've got to learn to speak English. And they've trashed the bilingual education system, and they trashed the scientific taxonomic system while they did it. And nobody cares. Nobody knows. Nobody cares. It's just incredible.
Quite extraordinary. So recently you went to Arnhem Land again with Mark Zimbecki to talk to people who live traditionally about changes in biodiversity. What did you learn from them about biodiversity on that trip, and what were their concerns and issues?
Well, this was well into the time period when our mammals started disappearing off the planet at varying rates, and Mark Zimbecki was quite interested in the older people of those various bush communities in eastern Arnhem Land and what they had observed in their lifetime in terms of the populations of wildlife, particularly the economic ones. So we had a lot of stuffed mammals that were loaned by the NT Museum, and a lot of rare things. And so Mark and I were able to drive to these remote communities and put all these things around so people could see them, feel them, and reminisce, and then tell us about what they'd experienced with each species. It was quite amazing because a lot of old people got very emotional when they saw things. Literally emotional, and that's because of that tie I was telling you about. And because they had disappeared in their lifetimes or had become extremely rare or whatever the case may be. And they then began pouring out information on former distributions of those animals and former abundance. And quite often, particularly if they were an economic species that the people hunted and ate, they still hunted and ate things that they loved, and they loved to see them alive, and they loved to see them on their landscape with them. So obviously, if you've got that kind of emotion, then you're not going to extinguish any species. You're going to manage it so it's always there, and that's obviously what they did. The disappearance that they experienced in their lifetime was something way beyond their control. And, of course, as we were going through Arnhem Land, the cane toads, which was the latest wave of destruction to arrive from white society, was just going through their country. And really, the toads had gone ahead of Mark and I, so the people were so disappointed that their goannas had disappeared. By goannas, I mean what they call junda out there, which is Varanus panoptes, the yellow spotted monitor, or the floodplains monitor. And that was like KFC in Arnhem Land. They were everywhere, big, juicy animals, which they loved. They loved to eat them, but they loved them as a species. And they were gone. And people were getting quite emotional about the fact that junda was gone. Where did it... What caused this horrible demise? They'd found some dead ones with toads in their mouth, but this was something completely foreign to them, that a species could go from common one day to gone the next. And then they started telling us about other things that had done the same thing. The king brown snake. Now, you'd think a large, venomous, elapid snake wouldn't be missed by a bunch of bush people living in the bush with them. It's the dead opposite. That large, venomous, elapid snake was part of their story. And while you had to watch where you put your feet, and you had to educate your kids well, it was part of who they were. And these big king brown snakes were gone. And that disturbed them greatly, as almost as much as an economic species that they hunted and ate. So we certainly got from the older sector of Arnhem Land society a lot of grief that in recent years things had just gone downhill and they couldn't understand why. They were blaming themselves. But of course we know the scourge that cane toads are that had gone through the landscape ahead. And cane toads, of course, were knocking down indirectly a lot of things as well as directly. The King Browns and the Yellow Spotted Monitors were direct impact, but they were losing all sorts of other things as a chain reaction result to the toads greatly disturbing their ecology. So it was clear to us there was a huge shift in former abundance of wildlife.
So one of the things is, I guess, the big issue now is to try and get the best handle on this stuff as quickly as we can and see what can be done to try and undo some of this. And obviously one of the really big issues with that for me is a partnership between Indigenous people and the researchers and so forth to help make that more accurate and more focused. But I'm just interested if you could reflect. I know we've spoken about this before and you've spoken about the impact of fire and the more so the changes in the nature of that fire rather than the fact that it's fire. You've also spoken to me on a number of occasions about the implications for food chains of things like cane toads, but more importantly, the changes that things like fire and land management and so forth might be creating in relation to things like termites, which are one of those really important underlay elements of our biodiversity. So if you could just talk for a minute and reflect on what you think are the big changes and where they might be impacting on this stuff so we can talk more about that.
Well, yes, I think firstly, you're right, this joint management thing has to be continued and it has to be improved. I don't think the federal government really understood what it was doing with joint management, but we do need to work together. And proof of that now is a lot of the Sea Ranger groups that have sprung up and the government is now beginning to see the value of and support. These people are getting the pride back in management of their land and are researching the former management skills themselves. So that's probably the quickest way to put the Blues Brothers back on the road, I think. And in terms of what we do and what they were doing that we're not doing, I think fire is a critical thing in amongst it. Fire seems to be able to pull the blanket out from underneath the ecology if you do it wrong. And if you've only got to look around the Darwin region to see what regular bad fire does to an ecosystem. And you've only got to go out to East Arnhem Land, where only traditional owners are burning, in the same kind of habitat, to see the difference and to see the value in what they do and the destructive way we do things here. And in my opinion, one of the worst factors of bad fire is that it takes out a food supply. We've got two things operating almost in competition. One is fire and one is termites. Now, termites, believe it or not, way down the bottom of the food chain, little tiny blind colonial insects that run around on the floor of the forest and up into the trees, and they're recycling lignin in a huge volume everywhere. Many species of termites, they're all doing it different ways, and at the end of every year, those termites are putting back into the ecosystem a huge amount of protein, which the rest of the living system is depending on and utilising for their own breeding systems and so forth. So termites, in my opinion, are ultra critical. They're the bottom layer. And they're recycling stuff that nothing else can recycle in large quantities, and it's going directly back in to that ecosystem. Now, if you get a hot fire through an area, that immediately takes away the food that the termites are processing. So their processing comes to a dead halt for that season until your grass grows and your leaf litter comes down again or whatever. Some termites eat grass specifically. Some eat twigs and leaves, and others hollow out trees. They're all doing it differently. But hot fire trashes everything and just puts it up into the atmosphere. And so they're disadvantaged for 12 months. Now, if you get hot fires for 2 and 3 and 4 years in a row, we've noticed around here those termite colonies die, okay? And with them goes a huge volume of food, which is supplying our birds, mammals and reptiles and fish and who knows what else, with a huge amount of critical food, which appears usually at the end of the dry season, and start when the humidity rises, the termites have their reproductive events and let their alates go, and that's when all the other animals are run down. They need a shot of protein, they need a lot of energy quickly for their own breeding purposes, and they depend on termites. And we, in our Western way, have not thought two figs about termites. They eat your house if you give them a chance. They're rubbish, we don't want them. And as a result, we've paid a huge price. And I think that's one of the major contributing factors to the demise of some of the animals further up the food chain, like the small mammals, particularly the small carnivorous mammals. They've suffered really badly. And in my opinion, this is a major contributing factor. So there are many aspects to the way in which Aboriginal people were operating and maintaining this wonderful balance with their gentle fires, gentle mosaic burning throughout the year without trashing everything in one go. They didn't run around in little bright red trucks with flashing lights on and squirt fire and water on fire and change things around. They knew what they were doing with fire, and they did it carefully, and they knew that what they were doing was advantaging most life forms. So we've got to start analysing these systems from their point of view and trying to replicate that again. I know there are a lot of places in northern Australia that think they're replicating Aboriginal burning regimes, but they're not. They don't understand what they're doing. So we really have to get a bit smarter, I think, in marrying those two systems back together again. Science, we now know, is not going to save us. We've got to use our intelligence, and we've got to look at what our Aboriginal brothers and sisters were doing and try and work together better to get a better result.
I remember going to a conference in New Guinea back when we were doing the Narungay project, and David Suzuki was the keynote speaker, and he and I were talking about this stuff, and he'd written that book, Wisdom of the Elders, and was talking about the general notion that right across the board, this enormous amount of wisdom and information that's held in traditional cultures, and how important that is to keep that. And I guess that's part of what you're saying here, is we've basically just pushed that knowledge set to one side and ignored it. And yet in there possibly lies a lot of the solutions we need to try and rebuild what we're losing.
Exactly, yeah.
An anecdote on that, I remember in 2003 we had an interesting experience with a feral cat at Gapwiak, and you ended up talking to an old lady for whom that feral cat was a fairly special animal. Can you give us a recount of what that story was and what you found out about them in the long run?
Well, that was a bit of we're all on a pretty sharp learning curve. Whenever you're in Arnhem Land, you learn amazing things. We had been asked by the CSIRO to collect feral cats from a scientific point of view and freeze them entirely so that they could be analysed for stomach contents and ageing by dentition and all that sort of thing. So they needed lots of frozen cats. So as you know, we shot whatever amount of feral cats we could come across. And on this particular occasion, we shot a large, it was you, I think, who shot the cat, a large feral cat crossing the road in the early hours of the morning. And it was so big and so fresh that we hung it on the bull bar to cool off a bit before we put it in our esky to take back, and drove into an Aboriginal community. And a young lady who was a former student of mine greeted us, and just after she greeted us, she advised us it would be a good idea to hide that cat from our hanging on our bull bar because it was her mother's clan emblem. And I was a bit confused when she said that, and I said, "Oh, you mean the quoll, do you?" No, pussycat, that one. Your mother's clan emblem. Her mother was a member of a clan group called Ritdarangul. And so on this information, I quickly whipped the cat down and we whacked him in an esky. And I followed that up to be told by the old lady that, yes, indeed, pussycat, or Malwurrumbur, as they call them out there, had been a part of their clan story for a long, long, long time. And they had songs and they had a lot of traditional information about pussycats on the landscape. She did say that there were only one colour pussycats in Arnhem Land when she was a little girl, and that was the tabby colour, and they were extremely wary of humans, and occasionally a ginger one would turn up, she said, but whether it was a tabby or the ginger, if when she was young and anybody in their clan came across cat tracks, their best hunter would be dispatched to go and track that cat down and bring it back for food. They loved eating them as well. So that's what would happen. And as a result, cats, as far as she was concerned, were always very rare, rarely encountered, and usually tracked down and eaten when they were encountered. And what she seemed to think had happened was once Europeans turned up in all these places and they brought all these multicoloured monkeys with them from Europe, they went out into the bush. They're much smaller animals. They crossbred with the wild ones. And at the same time, we introduced lots of new food supply into places like Arnhem Land through trade stores and things like that. So there was no longer any great pressure to go and hunt cats, and they stopped hunting cats when she was quite young. And as a result, that took the lid off the cat control, and feral cats are a real problem out there now, all colours. And it does appear that the cat has been in Australia much longer than the Europeans who first went out into places like Arnhem Land. So just how far back pussycats go, we don't know, but it's assumed they probably go back to the late 1600s when foreign vessels started crashing onto our coastline. And most of those, as we understand, carried cats. So they've probably been in Australia a lot longer than we think. And certainly, wherever I go, I ask Aboriginal people, and the answer is always the same. Yes, the cats have been here long before Europeans.
Mm. Interesting.
So in terms of the way forward with a lot of this stuff, it seems that we've had some projects in recent times. I know through the work that we've done together in Frogwatch and getting information together around cane toads and getting research people like the work we've just been doing recently with Sean Doody and others and a whole bunch of scientists who are all trying to tackle onto issues around a big problem, and it's only one piece of the overarching problem we've got, it appears. But the mechanism behind that in terms of getting Indigenous people involved and getting scientists involved, getting community groups involved, I know you were at a workshop about this time last year where there was a lot of discussion around the issue of community engagement and community involvement. Can you just reflect for a minute on where you think we need to look in relation to building solutions to this problem?
Well, I think in Australia up till now, land management has been entirely in the hands of National Parks Association and other conservation, state conservation agencies. And it's exclusive. They've had total access to land management of government land. It's now becoming clear that that's not working too well, and it hasn't been working too well. And it's kind of made the general population believe that, you know, that's what rangers do. They look after nature and endangered animals and things like that. It's not us. I think our education system has to start educating our kids from a very early age that we're all responsible for it. I think government legislation needs to be changed to allow more involvement from the community, and I think from a fairly early age if possible, so that our young Aussies feel responsible for what's around them. I think we need better environmental education in our schools, something that really looks at who we are and how it works and how humans can contribute better. I really do think that the bulk of our population has no interest in conservation or no involvement in it and no direct concern. It's out there, you know. And
yeah, I guess that's an outcome of being excluded.
Yeah, and I think we've got to start addressing things right there and work our way up so that Australians are proud of what they've got and are prepared to get involved and perhaps spend more money as individuals in ensuring that our environment stays as healthy as we can make it. It's an ever-increasing problem throughout the world in different forms. In every country, we're getting more and more land surface cleared, less and less places for natural ecosystems to function, and we've really got to start being smart. And Australia is running out of natural landscape in a scary way, I think. So we really have to change things. I think the government's got to learn to reach out into the community and get a lot more community involvement and perhaps let go of their or modify their legislation so that people can get involved and start helping with endangered species. And, I think it's no longer an exclusive area. We've got non-government agencies that are functioning today much, much better than the government agencies like the National Parks and Wildlife Services and so on. So the writing's on the wall. It's just how quickly we can achieve this.
Certainly in terms of models. I mean, if you look at the work I've just come back from at El Questro, the engagement with Australian Geographic and the volunteers that come into that process, without the work that those sort of people do, that research wouldn't happen. You just wouldn't be able to afford it, and the scientists wouldn't be able to fit the research load into the time they've got. So it's invaluable to have that community involvement, both in terms of the work being done, but also in terms of funding it.
Exactly. And, I mean, at the moment, governments are pulling back on conservation funding in all areas, simply because they can get away with it. The politicians clearly don't see a lot of value in conservation, and nobody's making a fuss about the fact that, you know, lots of funding is being cut. We're really paying a serious price here. So we've got it's public awareness that's probably our biggest underlying problem.
So you're probably one of our most experienced ecologists in terms of the time you've spent out in the bush up here and the amount of time you've spent with Indigenous people and National Parks people and all the other players in between. What are your best guesses, just purely in terms of your instincts, around where we should be focusing some of our research effort to try and get on top of some of these issues and the process that might take us there?
We don't know very much about the animals that are in trouble, and now we're paying the price for that. Animals such as the small vertebrate, maybe say the antechinuses, the smithopsises, the planigales. We know virtually nothing about their life cycles. We know they're out there in certain habitats at certain times, but in terms of managing them, we're not in a very good position. And when they start disappearing, we don't even notice till they're not there at all. And so, you know, there are serious problems with how we're viewing our ecosystems. Where we start to start reversing things, I think, is understanding the system that that animal lives in better. And we don't put much effort into that. So analysing communities of plants and animals and their function, I think, should be a subject in school. It should be something that people get more exposure to. And our national parks, they don't go into this anymore. Their emphasis these days is on tourism and the dollar. So as far as ecology research is concerned, there's less and less of that happening. And I think that's going to cost us dearly more in the future, unfortunately, till we reverse that. So my personal thoughts are Aboriginal people were in a much better position than we are today. None of us are in a very good position now, but we have given up a lot of access to a lot of good ecological information, the sort of things that will help us turn this issue around. So we've got to start really looking at, wherever possible, how we can get that picture together again. Australia was running beautifully. We know that by the diversity that used to be in these places. Kakadu in 1979 was an amazing place. I lived there. I lived with all the wildlife there. I was just knocked out by what was there. And today I'm just knocked out by what's not there. What used to be there and used to be abundant has been quietly disappearing. And so I think it's no appreciation of what's out there and what we've got, what's special about it, or B, how it functions. And in order to manage anything, I think you've not only got to know a particular species, you've got to know how it functions in its environment, the plants, the animals. And this is where even the primary school kids that I taught in Arnhem Land in the late 60s and 70s, they knew all that stuff. Kids knew all that stuff. The little preschool kids used to be able to tell me the names of all the grasses around the school, the native grasses, and the trees, and the winds from certain directions. They had special names. The stars. They had all this stuff when they came into school. Our education system has made them leave that at the gate, along with their native languages, and concentrate on English, which takes them back to zero as students. And then they have to learn things that probably aren't relevant to their future lives, especially in terms of managing land. So our system is upside down, back to front. We've got to help our system to see that. At the moment, they don't want to know that. And it's very, very difficult for people like me to talk to the government and say, hey, we're going down the wrong road in a big hurry. We've got to start analysing what we're doing and where we're going.
Now, hopefully this workshop might be the first step on that journey.
Good luck.